This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Joan Ruff. She is a member of the AARP Board of Directors and is in Baton Rouge, and we will talk with her in studio about the future of Medicare and Social Security. Also on the show, the tragedy in Oklahoma has captivated the nation, and we'll talk with former LSU linguistics professor Hugh Woodstock Buckingham, who was a few miles away from Moore, Oklahoma, when the storm roared through there this week. Hugh Buckingham with some thoughts about the tragedy in the Sooner State. And James Scott, his book is gaining much attention, The War Below, the story of three submarines that battled Japan. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. We begin with Joan Ruff. She's a member of the AARP Board of Directors, is an executive, a human resources consultant, an attorney, lives in suburban Kansas City in Mission Woods, Kansas, and she is in Baton Rouge to talk about Medicare and Social Security, and for that matter, Medicaid. And as we know, yesterday was a big day at the Capitol. The Louisiana House snuffed out any chance of legislative passage of a Medicaid expansion to provide health insurance to an estimated 400,000 of the state's working poor. The move came after Governor Jindal rejected state participation and said he would veto any bill that came to his desk. Were you at the Capitol yesterday?
I was not at the Capitol, but we had our people from the state office in the Capitol.
What's your take on what happened?
Well, obviously, we are disappointed, but AARP does believe that all people, regardless of health status and income, mm-hmm. really are entitled to have quality health care. So we are in it for the long term, and we will continue to fight for health care to all individuals.
Now, there are governors in the 50 states. Some are in accord with Governor Jindal, like Rick Perry of Texas. Kevin, let's see if we can get that cut ready with Rick Perry, who's been even more demonstrative in his opposition to this than has Governor Jindal. But there are others, mostly Democrats, who are saying this is a good thing and that it'll save their states a lot of money. What's the position in your home state of Kansas and neighboring Missouri?
Well, Kansas and Missouri are states that we need to do some work with to make sure that they do, in fact, expand Medicaid. And,
so it's still up in the air. It's up in the air there as well.
Correct.
On the surface, it seems like a no-brainer. The federal government's offering money to the states. In the first 3 years, it's, 100%, isn't it? So why is there this strong opposition? What's the reason, in your judgment?
Well, in my judgment, it is that the voters are not letting their legislators know exactly where they fall on the issue, and that they're not understanding totally what it is that not expanding Medicaid does for their lower-income individuals in the states, and how important it is from an economic standpoint to make sure that you have healthy people who have the ability to go out and have full-time jobs, to continue to be students, because it's having a healthy citizen that makes a healthy economy.
Now, the vote in the House was not even close, 37-4 and 59 against. So the governor of Louisiana, despite sagging poll numbers, is packing a wallop at the Capitol. And he's not a lone wolf, as Joan Ruff of the AARP notes. There are other governors who are in accord with Bobby Jindal and some or less conservative than he, but one who is the conservative's conservative, the man that Bobby Jindal wanted to be president of the United States last year, Rick Perry of Texas. Here he is.
I say Medicaid doesn't need to be expanded. It needs to be saved and reformed. We care about our poorest Texans. We want them to have the best care possible, and that cannot happen with a program that is on its way to bankruptcy.
That's Rick Perry, the mentor to Governor Bobby Jindal. You're smiling, Joan. Are you smiling through the pain, or do you think that Governor Perry makes some good points?
I mean, we agree that the healthcare system needs some changes. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's what one of the things that Governor Perry is talking about. We also believe that you can bring people into the healthcare system while you're making other changes. And those changes would be things like we need to make sure that we have better care coordination. We need to use technology to streamline care. We need to focus on prescription drugs, bringing down the cost of prescription drugs, and again, attacking fraud and abuse and over-testing. So that is not in contradiction to what Governor Perry is wanting to do. What we're saying is do both at the same time, because this is ultimately about people, and people cannot wait for health care until the whole system is revamped.
297-5633, still time to get in and talk with Joan Ruff of the AARP, the organization that represents people all over the United States. How many members now?
We have 37 million.
Plus. 37 million. So that's about one out of every nine Americans. That's a lot of people. And you got to be 50 years old, right? You can't sign up when you're a young person like Mr. Gallagher across the hall there.
That 50 is our minimum age, but maybe we can look at a junior membership. I'll take that under consideration.
All right. 297-5633 is your number. Now, this bill, House Bill 233, was backed by Democrats, but some Democrats did not vote for it yesterday. But when I say it was backed by Democrats, you have the conservative wing of the party, Senator Ben Nevers, who, is, after all, is the author of the Louisiana Science Education Act. He was pushing it on the Senate side, and Patricia Smith of Baton Rouge on the House side. Smith said that it would save our state $300 million through 2016, but lawmakers said no way. Is this politically motivated? I think that's the elephant in the room. Is it politics or is it policy that is driving the boat here?
The policy, good policy says it should be passed, and we should have health care. We should expand Medicaid eligibility.
So it is politics. Is that your answer?
It would seem to be.
All right. So how does this impact Medicare, if at all, which, of course, is a benefit for those over 65 years of age? How does the Medicaid morass affect Medicare, if at all?
Well, Medicare is definitely a separate program. And when we look at Medicare, we recognize that in doing our interviews with our members, they know that they have been paying in for many years to Medicare. It is a government program that they have earned through paying in over many, many years, and they do not want changes to it. We realize there need to be responsible solutions because there will be financial issues down the line, and we have to face those. Again, we look at the first, though, criteria being how do we streamline the healthcare system, bring down costs, which I mentioned earlier were technology for care coordination, high cost of drugs, mm-hmm. and fraud, abuse, and over-testing. So we need to really attack those first.
Well, according to the figures that I have, 97% of Louisiana seniors, that's 537,000 people, were enrolled in Medicare in 2011. For those who are so steadfast against government benefits, why is there this overwhelming endorsement of Medicare and this denouncement of Medicaid? Is there a disconnect here?
It is probably because people don't understand the differences between the two. And those Medicare, people recognize that it is for those who are 65 and above. It is the primary and only form of health care coverage for those individuals. It is impossible for a person who's 65 and above mm-hmm. to really go out and get their own personal insurance. The rates would be astronomical, and pre-existing conditions, et cetera, would keep many of them from being able to get other insurance. So they recognize mm-hmm. that this is a fundamental building block for their security through the rest of their lives.
Well, only 3% of those over 65 and older in Louisiana, are without Medicare, but in contrast, 18% of those between 50 and 64 are uninsured.
And that is a critical issue. One of the things that at AARP, we want to focus very much on the issues of those who are 50 to 64. And when you look at that age group, it's particularly troublesome because they are generally out of work longer than younger adults, and they do not have the funds available to pay for private insurance, and many of them are just waiting until they're Medicare age eligible to be able to get health insurance.
297-5633 for Joan Ruff of the AARP. Charles on North Foster. Charles, you're on the air with Joan. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Joan. I have a quick comment and a question. Louisiana has received billions of dollars from the federal government for every imaginable disaster. Yet the governor says it would cost $1 billion over 10 years to expand Medicaid. My problem with how this was done in the legislature is, and I would like to hear your guest comment, is why didn't they put this matter before the people to vote on? I don't believe that the legislature, quite frankly, is competent enough to decide who lives and dies based on affordable health care.
I appreciate your comment, and I agree that the population of Louisiana needs to make its voice heard. And that means that you all need to contact your representatives, tell them what you're thinking, tell them why you totally support expansion of Medicaid, and that's the way you're going to make it happen.
Well, according to some reports, the Medicare program, those over 65 in Louisiana, estimated $5 billion annual spending for Louisiana alone. Is that a correct estimate? $5 billion, that's a lot of money.
Yes, that is correct. Estimated $4.88 billion, you're right.
Well, it's a big entitlement. It's one that is wildly popular, and I think that may be one of the reasons why people don't want to expand Medicaid, is that once an entitlement is in place, people tend to like it. They don't want to give it up. And there are those who, for example, the governor has all his health care taken care of. His whole family is taken care of. The taxpayers of Louisiana take care of that. But there are those who do not want to have the public at large to have the same kind of access. Is that somewhat inconsistent?
Well, again, it goes back to everything. It is about the people. And people who do not have health care cannot be as productive citizens because they have a tendency to be much to have extreme illnesses because they don't have preventive care. When you don't have preventive care, you wait until you are very ill, then you go to the emergency room. When you're in the emergency room, services are much, much more expensive, and the chances of full recovery are less, and it makes it more expensive and difficult for everybody else who has health insurance. So we have to look at it as this being an economic driver rather than trying to separate or segregate people who are the haves from have-not. And from that standpoint, it comes down as well to a people issue. We must look at it as a moral issue and make sure that everybody has access to quality health care.
Tracy at the Capitol notes that Congressman Cassidy, of course, is running for the U.S. Senate, has said that he will participate in the Obamacare exchanges, that he will essentially give up the benefits he has as a member of Congress, and he's urging Congressman Cassidy as other legislators to do the same, and the President of the United States to do the same, and hats off to Congressman Cassidy. Shouldn't they be playing by the same rules as the rest of us?
I certainly think that if they don't play by the same rules, they at least should be cognizant of the rules that everyone else is playing by and have empathy for what other people are looking at and doing.
But when you're in a member of Congress and you're in the Senate and you're in the chosen 100, there's a tendency to think you're a little more special than the rest of the people in the world and in the country.
I think you're right. And it's how do we get people to recognize that they aren't special by being legislators?
Well, let's see if Senator Landrieu and Senator Vitter follow the lead of Congressman William Cassidy. We'll return with Joan Ruff, and we also will hear from Hugh Buckingham, who's in Oklahoma, a survivor of the terrible tornado earlier this week. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 877-217-5757 is your long-distance number, and meaning if you're calling outside Baton Rouge, and if you're local, 297-5633. Now, our guest for a bit longer is Joan Ruff, a board member of the AARP. How many board members do you have?
We have 22 volunteer board members.
22, all volunteer board members. So what happens if you vote on something and it's an 11-11 tie? What happens then?
We re-vote.
Okay. A total of 89%, or 509,000 of the Louisiana residents above 65, receive Social Security. The average benefit, $12,900. That's a bit tough to live on, isn't it? How do these folks make do if that's the only income they have?
It's extremely tough. And these are not just numbers from the state of Louisiana. I mean, it's not unusual throughout the 50 states that 50% or more of seniors are living on Social Security for 90% of their income.
George on Perkins. George, good morning. You're on the air with Joan Ruff of the AARP. Hi, George.
Morning to you both.
Good morning.
I sort of dropped off about 10 minutes ago. I caught the beginning of the show. Jim asked you a question about why Governor Jindal is opposed to Medicaid expansion, and you didn't really answer. I mean, there must be some reason why he doesn't want to share in these funds, and I'm wondering if you could address it. Incidentally, I'm 71 years old, and I am an AARP member.
Thank you. I'm glad you're a member.
I don't know if she can read Governor Jindal's mind, but I think he's sincere in his opposition to this. He thinks it's a program that's not good and shouldn't be expanded, period, right. End of story. And he wants to be president of the United States, and it's part of the Republican playbook right now, partially written by his mentor, Rick Perry, that all governors who are conservative Republicans should reject it. So he's rejecting it. 16%, 84,000 of older Louisianians living in poverty. That's a lot of people. It's one thing to live in poverty when you're 25 and you've got an able back and strong legs and you're not dealing with the ravages of age and other things. How do these people survive?
They make it day to day, and many of them are calling us at the offices in Louisiana, and they're talking to us about their stories and looking for help. They talk about how they cannot afford food and prescriptions both, how they have to make decisions mm-hmm. one day to the next, how they rely, and many of these individuals are also taking care of other family members. Many more older Americans are taking care of their grandkids, and so it really makes the situation even more dire.
Now, the Medicare program, as we noted, is about $5 billion a year. The Social Security program in Louisiana, is $9.6 billion in benefits in 2011, so about $10 billion. So between the two, about $15 billion pumped into the Louisiana economy. For those who say Social Security is a bad thing, Medicare is a horrible thing, what would happen to our economy if we took all that off the table and people didn't have that to spend on their basic needs?
I think it's an excellent point. It benefits the state of Louisiana, as you say, putting money into the economy, and it's also essential to the individuals who are receiving Social Security. And from the other standpoint, as you pointed out, those who are receiving Social Security do not have a way to increase their earnings outside of what they're receiving currently and in Social Security. They were hurt very hard by the recession. They do not have the ability to earn back money that they may have lost through savings. And therefore, we really do need to focus on making sure that Social Security doesn't have any benefit cuts.
You have 37 million members. Approximately what percentage is that, Joan, of those above the age of 50 in the United States? Is it more than half? I would think it's...
It's less than half, and we're always increasing our membership. and it does increase mm-hmm. each year. So we continue to focus on the issues that are very important to those people who are 50 and above, and will continue to do so. And we do have probably 30% of the 50 and above group.
What do you say to those who say this is a political organization, that it's left-leaning, that it's not for me, I'm not in accord with the politics of the AARP? What do you say to those people?
We are, first and foremost, a bipartisan organization, and we do not take political sides.
Well,
we
look at issues. Fox News says it's bipartisan. It's fair and balanced, but we know it's not. What about, it's one thing to say it. What do you have to show that you're a bipartisan organization?
We look at issues from how it affects our membership and those, even those who are not our members, who are 50 and above, and how it affects their families. So we take positions on issues regardless of who might be supporting them. And I would say that when we focused on prescription drug Part D under Medicare, that was under a Republican administration. With ACA, it was a Democrat administration.
That was George Bush. Now, some are criticizing him, and some on the right, I might say, because that certainly was a big budget buster. It cost a lot of money for those prescriptions, and that was a George Bush initiative. Now, if President Obama had done the same thing, he probably would have been castigated up one side and down the other. The criticism against President Bush has been rather mild, but some say to his credit or to his blame, he did this. Has that been a good thing as far as the prescriptions that are now available?
It's critical that people have prescriptions available. One of the other issues, though, is the donut hole, which the ACA has helped to get rid of that donut hole over time. So it is important, but it's critical. The next step, though, is making sure that the cost of prescription drugs come down. And that means that we have to be able to negotiate
Senator Vitter wants to bring in drugs from Canada. Is that a good idea?
I think it's a solution that we need to really look at. I mean, we need to be able to bring down the cost of drugs and do it in the most feasible way possible.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Joan Ruff, AARP, one of 22 board members representing 37 million Americans and many in Louisiana. I did get a question online about the state's over 65 population. It's about 15% of Louisiana. Is that higher than the average around the country? Do we have an older than average populace in Louisiana, or is it about the same?
It's about the same.
About the same. Mm-hmm. And I would think so, because Louisiana has a shorter lifespan, so it would make sense that we would have about the same or maybe fewer people over 65. But thank you. I know you're from Kansas City or the Kansas City area, not too far from Moore, Oklahoma. What is
Correct.
It? A couple hundred miles?
About 150, 200 miles.
200 miles. You've been following the story out of Oklahoma the last few days, I'm sure.
Very closely. Very closely.
Well, thank you, Joan.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by Hugh Buckingham. We've heard him for many years on this show. Longtime professor at Louisiana State University. Spent 30 years or more teaching linguistics at LSU. Hugh at LSU, who now lives in suburban Oklahoma City. And we will hear his voice in just a moment. He is one of the survivors. The story today that is the top one in the New York Times at the end of the day on Monday, on the last week of the school year in Moore, Oklahoma, at Plaza Towers Elementary in a blue-collar suburb. Kids were zipping their backpacks. A fifth-grade class had just finished watching Hatchet, about a boy who survives a crash landing in the Canadian wilderness. Then the sirens started to wail. Claire Gossett's teacher hurried her fifth-grade class into a hallway, then into a bathroom, as a tornado that was more than a mile drew closer. Claire, who is 11, crammed into a stall with six other girls. They held on to each other. The sirens wailed 2, 3, 4 times. Echo Mackey, crouched in a hallway, hugging her son Logan, a first grader, said, "I heard someone say it's about to hit us, and then the power went out." The mountain of rubble that was once Plaza Towers Elementary School has become the emotional and physical focal point of one of the most destructive tornadoes to strike the United States. Although the casualty toll fluctuated wildly early on, officials say 24 people have died, including 9 children, 7 of them at Plaza Towers. Good morning to you, Hugh Buckingham.
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing probably a little better than you are. What were you doing when this tornado, this catastrophe occurred?
Well, first of all, let me say that I don't really consider myself a survivor. I think the survivors actually were the ones down there who, by hook or crook, most of them still are alive, but who actually were there underneath this horrible and terrifying funnel. So I'm not really a survivor. Most of the people in the area feel a little bad about it. We were just fortunate.
Well, I'm sure you saw the funnel cloud.
Yes, well, we had been in our little inside room before just to make sure, but when it looked like it was definitely not coming here, we went out, the TV was on, and at that time, that funnel was forming, and it was frightening enough to see that part, and then it, of course, was going right where it should have on called Tornado Alley, and it looked like it was a strike because it was going right for more where it had been in 99. It got bigger and bigger. And of course, the TV pictures don't show you what's going on underneath. You just see this very frightening funnel, and you just hope to God, well, my gosh, what's going on underneath? So you watched it for like 17 minutes. It was a mile and a 0.3 diameter, and it cut right through where everyone knows it went. Then what we saw was something I had never seen before, because it roped out. Once it got, say, several miles beyond the more destruction area, the tornado actually roped out. It's what they call it. And it formed, again, a very thin line. And it did look like a rope. It actually looped once. Mm-hmm. And then it disappeared. And it the whole thing was a fascinating, frightening, and sorrowful, scene.
Well, the website for the city of Moore, Oklahoma, recommends that every residence have a storm safe room or an underground cellar. It says below ground shelters are the best protection against tornadoes. This is something people live with in Oklahoma, like we live with hurricanes in Louisiana. After all, the NBA team is called the Thunder. Hugh Buckingham, tornadoes, as you found out, are much more devastating than are hurricanes as far as the place where they land. The kind of destruction and rubble that occurs in something like this, it's as though a nuclear bomb has been dropped in that particular area. It is hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there have been several stories now on the people there who did happen to have storm shelters. They, of course, were all okay. And my wife and I are now definitely in the search for a very good storm shelter to be built from within our garage. They will come in the garage, drill down and build the shelter right there. I mean, they could put it in different places, and different people have them in different locations, but we're going to go with one that's going to be put within our garage. We have a two-car garage, and if any of the cars have to stay out while we're in there, then it'll probably be mine.
Well, it's a tragic situation, and it affects all of America. It's reminiscent of the Oklahoma City bombing that occurred 18 years ago now. Hugh Buckingham, there's a listener, and he's not being facetious here. He asks, how in the world did Hugh Buckingham end up in a state that in which every county voted for Mitt Romney? Romney carried every county in Oklahoma. This is from Mark in Hammond, and he is exactly right. How did you end up in Oklahoma, Hugh Woodstock Buckingham?
Well, I drove my Honda when I left Baton Rouge.
That's your Honda car, right?
Yeah.
And you got to Oklahoma, but why did you choose the wonderful Sooner State to be the place where you're spending your septuagenarian years?
Well, that's because my lovely wife, Sarah, lives here, and she's full-time working at the medical center. And I figured this was the place for me. And we still own our home in Baton Rouge, but I am here, and Louisiana is fairly Republican, and so is Oklahoma. That's just the nature of this area, I think. But I maintain my autonomy and my political persuasions.
Well, another listener points out, and it's this may not be the time for this, but I'll go ahead and convey the message that when Louisiana, particularly New Orleans, was hit by Hurricane Katrina, there were those on the right flank of the political spectrum who said it was God's retribution because of New Orleans' reputation as being a sin city. Well, here's Oklahoma, who's church-going, largely conservative Republican, and yet there's this terrible tragedy occurs in your state, your adopted state now. When it comes to these sorts of things, I think God stays out of the way, Hugh. It has nothing to do with whether or not people are pious or devout. It's just a terrible tragedy no matter how you cut it.
Well, the discussion on that point has been going on in the community quite a bit. Whether you are a fatalist or not, or whether you are just a racist and have other kind of Christian tendencies to, for instance, be very anti-gay. And that's what gave rise to that awful statement that this was God's retribution on the gay population in New Orleans. But that's expected.
Well, where are these people now, though? What are they saying about Oklahoma?
Well, they're not saying anything like that. First of all, there was no gay issue in Moore. That was gone. So they're saying it could have been an act of God, but that's to make certain people feel well when something sad like this happens. Quite often, the believer, it feels better to say it's God's will. That's fatalism, and there's nothing you can do about that.
All right. Well,
the argument then is, why would God be so evil?
There is no local ordinance or building code in Oklahoma, I'm told, that requires shelters and houses, schools, or businesses. And because of that, only about 10% of the homes in Moore, Oklahoma, have them. Do you think that will change as a aftermath of this terrible catastrophe?
No, probably not. There's too many Republicans up here.
Are you being whimsical, or are you being sincere in that?
Well, I do a lot of sincere speaking whimsically.
Well, I know your wife is a conservative Republican. I would imagine there's some robust discussions in the Buckingham living room on occasion.
Oh, no, but she's not a libertarian, and she doesn't share many of the social views, if any, of the Republicans. None of them.
All right. Well, we'll get back to the storm and talk more with Hugh Woodstock Buckingham, who was a few miles away when this catastrophe occurred in Moore, Oklahoma. 297-5633, back after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. This tragedy in Oklahoma, 24 known dead. Remember 2011, a monster tornado raised large parts of Joplin, Missouri. In that catastrophe, 160 people were killed in a state that also has no storm shelter requirements. We're talking with Hugh Buckingham, the former professor at Louisiana State University, who now lives in the Oklahoma City area. And he has survived, if you will, the tragedy of this week in Moore, Oklahoma. But I think you're right. The people who survived are those who were literally in the eye of the tornado, who had to weather this and see their friends and loved ones in some cases die. It's unfathomable as far as how life can change in a split second, Hugh.
It certainly is, and that's another thing that everyone perceives up here with the nature of tornadoes, and it's always discussed about the difference of the way a tornado approaches and a hurricane. There are lots of differences.
Well, does that give you pause? Do you think about moving back to a safer abode in Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
Well, there's really not much of a chance of that right now. You know, my wife is tenured. She's very busy. She loves her job. A lot of good people around here. And I don't think this is really a good time for a lot of academicians to be leaving a spot they've had for almost 20 years and moving around. So I think for the time being, Sarah and I are here.
Are you following the travails at LSU from your perch in suburban Oklahoma City?
Of course. I get the Tiger Rag, and I read it, and I have friends and colleagues in Baton Rouge, and we discuss things. I have the Internet. I go on quite often for the athletic department and read. So, yeah, I keep up with it.
Well, you keep up with it. What's your assessment of how things are at your former employer, the place where you were a fixture on campus for three decades or more?
Well, I think athletics is going the way you would expect athletics to be going, with the same sort of juggernaut financial success and some of the problems with the kids playing. You know, these are teenagers and 20 years old and full of testosterone. I would suggest that everyone read the May 7th Rag and read Glenn Gilbo's article, and you're equally...
thanks for the plug. Let's go to a few...
No, but it's true.
Okay. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, please be brief. Phil, you're on with Hugh Buckingham. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Good morning. Yeah, my question for you, sir, is I think as Senator Inhofe is broadcasting that he is going to not approve, or he's going to politicize this disaster by insisting on some offsets before he'll approve disaster relief in another his state that's been hit. And I know he messed with the Sandy relief. What do you think about that? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's disingenuous for anybody, Democrat or Republican, to say that most of what they're going to do is not political. Everything is political now in this country.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on the air with Hugh Buckingham. Hi, Barry.
Yeah. Good morning. Good morning, Hugh. I was in a tornado in Omaha, Nebraska on May 6, 1975. It was huge and massive, going all through Omaha. We were in our synagogue there, Temple Israel. We took our kids and our staff down into a sub-basement. And that's the thing I lament, that these people who didn't have such a place in Oklahoma were missing. And I will always remember that tornado that came through our synagogue and took other churches along with it. We lost three people from Omaha during that storm because a month earlier we had a tornado warning and people didn't pay attention to it. Mayor Ed Zirinsky, who was then the mayor of blessed memory, really scolded the whole city, and that really got our attention. So we just are all living with risk. And my heart, and I know the hearts of all of us here in Louisiana, go out to the folks in Moore and in Oklahoma.
Well, I didn't know about the Omaha storm that almost got you. You might not have been here without that storm shelter.
That's right. It was terrible. We left the downstairs of the synagogue, went up into the sanctuary, and it was raining. It took us a year and a half or longer to get things restored, but I hope we all can keep in mind the helpfulness of everybody when these natural tragedies do happen.
Well, we commend the Louisiana Red Cross, which has sprung into action and is helping the folks in Oklahoma. This brings out the best in people amid the calamity and catastrophe that folks in Oklahoma have experienced. Thank you, Barry. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
My guess is that the synagogue in Omaha was in Mid-City. Thank you. Hugh Buckingham, what's the feeling there? What are people buzzing about when you get out of the house? And I'm sure you go to coffee shops in Oklahoma, as you did in Baton Rouge. What's the take?
Well, the take is that a lot of people do have friends or relatives or acquaintances that live down there and that have been affected. So those are the first things that come up, some of the personal connections to people who were there. But essentially, I'm amazed at how wonderfully this community has reacted to that tragedy. And it's generally very, very impressive. I think, again, since that area is called Tornado Alley, a lot of people here will simply say, well, you know, it's May.
Well, we hope you'll be back soon, Hugh Buckingham. Always good to visit with you. I'm glad you're listening to the show online and reading Tiger Rag and staying up to date on all the good things that happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got a game today at 12:30, so we'll be watching.
There you go. Thank you, Hugh. Take care, Dr. Buckingham.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. We're joined now by James Scott, former investigative reporter with the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina, 2007 Nieman Fellow for Journalism at Harvard. He's the author of The Attack on Liberty, which won the Samuel Eliot Morrison Award, and his latest work is The War Below, the story of three submarines that battled Japan. The book is getting nice plaudits around the country, published by Simon & Schuster. Historian James Hornfisher says this is the most absorbing narrative of submarine warfare that I've read in years. The research is deep, the writing vivid. I could practically feel the vast ocean closing over me as three boats range the Pacific looking for the kill. The War Below is the riveting story of the submarine force that helped win World War II in the Pacific by ravaging Japan's merchant fleet and destroying the nation's economy. Good morning, James Scott. James, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry, it just flashed out on me there.
Okay,
I was listening to the promo and then it went out. So.
All right, well, you focus on the stories of three of the war's top submarines, Silversides, Drum, and Tang. How significant were they in the war in the Pacific?
You know, these three boats had a significant impact, and that's kind of one of the reasons I picked them. Is I was looking for, you know, the submarine war in the Pacific was huge. You know, you had almost 300 boats that served, and I was looking to find three boats that sort of were a microcosm, if you will, for the larger war effort. And so each of these boats had very unique stories, very successful records, and that I felt kind of helped create that microcosm.
How vivid was the warfare in the Pacific at that time between the United States and Japan?
Incredibly so. I mean, and that's the thing about the submarine war that a lot of people, you know, may not realize in looking back on it, is that the vital role that it really did play. I mean, Japan was a island nation. Its empire spread across 20 million square miles, seven time zones, and with troops stationed all over there, they had to be able to move everything from, you know, bullets and toilet paper to oil and weapons. And that's where the submarine war really played an incredible role. We were able to target not only their battleships and their aircraft carriers, but their merchant fleets that were the lifeline to holding that empire together. And so it was a war that was, you know, World War II is, a lot of people like to focus on big battles like Midway that were, you know, determined really in a matter of days, if not minutes. And the submarine war was one that was fought over days, weeks, and years. But the cumulative effort of that was the crippling of Japan's economy and the collapse of Japan's economy.
How did it collapse the economy? How did particularly these three submarines, what was so vital about their actions that caused the collapse of the Japanese economy?
Well, you know, if you take a look, these three submarines, over the course of the war, would sink more than 60 Japanese ships. And that's just a really massive amount of tonnage that they were able to put on the sea floor. And so it got to the point by the end of the war that Japanese people were not only out of war materials that they needed, like oil and gasoline and things like that, but they were out of food supplies. I mean, at the end of the war, some Japanese civilians were reduced literally to eating sawdust. I mean, it had just everything about, I mean, they were experimenting with wooden airplanes, fuel substitutes, even kamikaze missions were the result of not having enough fuel to be able to train your pilots in navigation. So it really did cripple their economy, both civilian and militarily. And these three boats, I mean, were some of the top scorers of the war. I mean, and so their contributions were, as I mentioned earlier, more than 60 Japanese ships put on the bottom.
60. James Scott is a man who has spent a few years on this project, more than 100 interviews with submarine veterans, and thousands of pages of previously unpublished letters and diaries are part of the War Below and the information that you unearthed. You write, James, that in retaliation for this, the Japanese, they beat, tortured, even starved, captured submariners in the atrocious prisoner of war camps. It wasn't a good thing if you got caught, was it?
Not at all. And they did. They had one of the crews I wrote about, the Tang, was the victim, unfortunately, of its own malfunctioning torpedo. And so the submarine was lost, and nine of the crew members got off and would spend the better part of the last year of the war in a Japanese POW camp. And the conditions there were just brutal. They starved them. You know, each of these men got out weighing less than 100 pounds. They beat them. The physical cruelty, the mental cruelty was just really overwhelming. And one of the fascinating things that the United States did is that in the end of the war, all these men who got out, these Allied prisoners of war, they sat them all down and they took depositions from them all. And so all those files still exist today. So it's a very, very haunting window into the atrocities that so many of these men did suffer. And all that's still preserved in the National Archives, which makes telling a story like this.
You write about an attack on an unmarked enemy freighter that was carrying 1,800 American POWs.
Absolutely. Exactly. There was a Wolfpack, which is a combination of when multiple submarines worked together and they had attacked a convoy, a Japanese convoy. And the Japanese didn't mark what they called hell ships. And they were called hell ships because the conditions on them were so bad and that it would literally cram Allied prisoners of war, in this case 1,800 of them, into the holds of cargo ships and transport them around the empire. And they didn't mark them with any kind of things to alert Allied bombers, Allied submariners, that these were carrying such precious cargo. And in this case, the Erisin Maru was the name of the ship. It was sunk, and only 9 of the 1,800 Americans survived.
9?
That's it, 9.
The war claimed almost 1 of every 5 submarines, and a crewman was 6 times more likely to die than a sailor on board a surface ship. How was the attitude, the morale, the conviction for the war? How was it for the people who were fighting on these ships or in these submarines?
You have to remember, this was an all-volunteer service. I mean, the Navy didn't assign you to a submarine. You had to raise your hand and volunteer for it. And the camaraderie on board submarines was very high. It was a more relaxed environment because these guys operated. They were independent fighters. You know, they wouldn't operate as part of a fleet. They would head off and go to Japan, go to Japanese occupied islands, and so they were on their own. And so that sense of dependence upon one another was very strong. But the conditions on board a submarine were very austere. There's no other way to describe it. I mean, men literally lived, 18 inches apart. They had bunks strung between torpedoes. In a lot of cases, they hot bunked, which means that they didn't have enough beds for everybody. And so you had to rotate sleeping shifts, and so the bed was always warm. But the fraternity among the men was strong as a result of this. But it certainly was. As you mentioned, it was one of the most dangerous jobs you could have in the United States Armed Forces. When a submarine was lost, typically the whole crew was lost. And only a handful of cases in the case of the Tang, were a few men able to get away. And so there's no doubt about it. It was a very, very dangerous assignment.
Randy and Zachary, you're on the air with James Scott, the author of The War Below. Hi, Randy.
Yes, I want to make mention that thousands of naval aviators were saved by subs. Thanks.
He says thousands of naval aviators were saved by subs.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it was more than 500 of them were. And what they would do is when we would be bombarding a Japanese-held island and aviators would get shot down, submarines were one of the best ways to rescue them because they could slip all the way in close into shore and pick them up. In fact, the Tang, which is one of the boats I write about, rescued 22 aviators in 1944, which was the record for a submarine. And it actually earned the Tang a nice, very nice write-up in Life magazine at the time.
We're short on time, James, but most of the people who were involved obviously are no longer with us. How did you find enough people who were available to talk, to get firsthand observations?
Well, I started my research a number of years ago, and there were, at that time, there were more of the men were alive than are today. I mean, we're sadly losing these men every single day. I was at a visitation, in fact, for one of the men I wrote about in my book just last week. In cases where the men had passed away, I tracked down family members through old obituaries and things like that, and were able to piece together the letters and the journals. And,
very good.
Very literate generation, era before Facebook and Twitter.
You got it.
Wrote a lot of letters.
The War Below, the story of three submarines that battled Japan, from James Scott and Simon and Schuster. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. And happy 90th birthday today to Lewis Loring Carter, host on WRKF for the last 33 years. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, thank you for listening, everybody, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.